Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. We have a full week of live programming for you this week, and my co-host Michelle Chosedowski will be back on Thursday, and he will be talking with Peter Dale Scott. He's been on the program a couple of times. Today the topic is the current economic crisis, and I hope Jack is on. Jack, I want to tell listeners about you, and I sent you an email this morning. I hope you spotted it. It's early your time, that if we can get through, I'm trying to reach Sami Habib in Gaza for a very, very brief segment. It's not easy getting through. There's a war going on there, and I tried on Friday, and we could not get through to him, so there's no idea whether we can do it or not. But if we do, I just want to get him on just for a few minutes to give a live account from his perspective of exactly what's going on. But, Jack, let me tell listeners about you. You're a professor of political economy at St. Mary's College and Santa Clara University in California. You're a freelance journalist, a frequent speaker, a playwright, my goodness, and author of books including The War at Home, The Bush Corporate Offensive Against American Workers and Their Unions. And you sent me an email with a book I didn't know about, and I listed another one. Let me mention that the new one that will be coming out, it may be out already, called Epic Recession and Global Financial Crisis. And I listed another one. You correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe this one is already out. I listed it as a forthcoming one titled The Trillion-Dollar Income Shift, Essays on Income Inequality in America. Is that already out, Jack? And welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Good morning. No, it's not out yet. It's being peddled around by my literary agent.
So you've got two books coming out?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness, two at one time. Well,
yeah, I'm kind of stepping on myself a little bit.
I'm very impressed. It's a major topic, and I read you whenever you write in Z Magazine, and your latest article in the January issue is a very important one. And you call it Epic Recession Revisited, and indeed it is an epic recession. I think we both agree, Jack, that at this point it's an epic recession, and depending on future policy, heaven knows what it could turn into.
No doubt. Quite unlike anything we've seen since 1945 in terms of recessions along a number of categories, which I outline in the article and, of course, elaborate more in the book. If you just look at what's happened in the last couple months, the massive amount of jobs that have been lost, which is just the beginning, and which, by the way, officially are quite underestimated. If you really look at all the ways of estimating joblessness, we've lost a million jobs in each of the last 2 months. The government statistics doesn't account for, example, underemployment. Part-time workers, you're considered fully employed if you are working 1 hour a week, according to the government. And we've had over 3 million part-time jobs created. In other words, while we're laying off 3 million in 1 year, regular full-time employees, we're creating and converting another 3+ million to part-time employment. So accurately, we should have an equivalent of another 1.5 million.
Oh,
and then we have another million.
Jack, that music means we're coming up on a commercial break. Let's take it, and we'll come right back.
Okay.
And Carrie, if you make contact with Sammy, please let me know. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Jack Ramses. Jack, let me mention one thing. I want to make an announcement. My co-host will be conducting a lecture for people in the Montreal area, and I believe that it will probably be recorded and posted on globalresearch.ca. And Jack, his topic is certainly one of interest to the two of us. He calls it the Global Financial Crisis, the Great Depression of the 21st Century. He's got an article on Global Research right now, featured up on top. It's the fourth article down. It's been up since the middle of November. And he titles his article, The Great Depression of the 21st Century, Collapse of the Real Economy. And below he has a tagline, the proposed bank bailout under the so-called TARP program is not a solution to the crisis, but the cause of further collapse. Gary, did I hear your voice? You
Hello?
Have Sandy. Jack, can I suspend you for one moment and
sure.
Let me just talk with Sammy for a few moments?
Fine.
Sammy?
Chris Thomas, PG.
Sammy, can you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Oh, Sammy, good morning again. Well, good afternoon, your time. It's after 6 o'clock, your
time. Good afternoon and good morning.
Oh, you're in Gaza. You're in the middle of the war zone.
Yes, but just could you raise your voice, sir?
Can you hear me?
Yes, but it's too low, so please.
It's too low?
Raise your voice a little
Gary,
bit.
Can you up the volume a little bit? Sammy, I can hear you. Briefly, give listeners an idea of what's going on around you in Gaza right now.
Okay. 17 days ago, as all of you know, Israeli army and Israeli defense ministry started its full-scale military actions against the Gaza Strip. Around 910 people were killed, around 4,100 injured. The military operation targeted all managerial offices, public service offices, schools, all you can imagine was destroyed by the Israeli military operation. And around a week, 1 week ago, the Israeli ground military operation and soldiers started to advance into the Gaza Strip, into many populated areas, leaving many people dead, mostly civilians. The clashes with the Palestinian fighters still erupted till this moment when I'm speaking to you, because some minutes ago more clashes were taking place east of Gaza City and in the north of Gaza Strip, where the F-16, the Apaches were taking place in the firing process, leaving around 5 people dead and 2 people were killed in one of the central squares here in the Gaza Strip, mostly civilians. They were hit by the car. Add to that, we have a very big humanitarian crisis in terms of the medical sector, in terms of food, bread, oil, water, everything you can imagine. We are not suffering from the issue of the war only. We are suffering from the ongoing crisis in terms of daily life.
How do you get food for yourself and for your family? How are you getting it?
We don't have enough food. What we are eating at the moment is something that we have saved lately. We have saved some food that we are trying to eat little by little. As you know, we cannot just eat all we have, and especially now Gaza Strip is being cut from the southern areas. And in the southern areas, we have like, the farms, we have the vegetables, fruits, and everything. And now, more than a week, nothing came from that area. People depend only on what they have already in their houses. So maybe like we could bring some rice, could bring some bread. At the moment, we cannot even get bread. So if we want to go and to bring some bread, so we have to wait more than 1 hour with the bread.
Sammy, in my latest article, I quoted 3 human rights organizations on the ground, including the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, and the estimate of civilians killed is somewhere between 80 and 90%. 80 and 90% of the deaths have been civilian men, women, and children. That's pretty horrific.
Yes, most of those who died, and I could use the number, is dramatically increasing. Now around the 350 people, they are children, 350 children at this moment, and around 150 women and other young people, and girls and guys who are youth, who have nothing to do with any kind of militants. And the number of the militants is like very small number, and those even who died at the first Israeli raids in Gaza on the first days of war were not from Hamas, they were from the policemen who joined the police in Gaza Strip newly. So the number of those who died, mostly from civilians, and a few out of this number is from the militants of Arab workers.
I don't call them militants, Sammy. I call them resistance. I call them freedom fighters. They don't attack, they defend. And they have a legal right. International law says if you're attacked, you have a right to defend yourself. And that's exactly what they're doing.
Yes, it's like...
When the Israeli forces kill police, Sammy, they're killing civilians.
By all the human principles. When the Americans were fighting for their freedom from the slavery, when the black were fighting for the freedom, when the Vietnamese were fighting the Americans who occupied their country, it's the right that no one can deny. It's like a basic right for all the human being to be like in resistance of those who occupy their land. And we are under occupation, and many people think that it's like a basic right to fight and to resist until you get to your feet countries.
And this has gone on for 41 years now. This didn't happen last week or last year. This happened in 1967 in June, and it never ended. Sammy, can we stay in touch ahead, and can I get you back on a future program, and you can say more about what's going on? I know the first time I talked to you last week, you asked me if I could hear explosions, maybe faintly, but not too clearly.
Yes, if you want to call me anytime, you're most welcome. But at the moment, I have to go to bring some bread, and I have to wait more time and time near one of the bakeries. And you know, it's very hazardous to go in the night. So I would try now. I'll give a try to bring some bread for my family. I know it's very hard and maybe impossible, but I would give a try. I went today some hours ago. Before you called me, and I was like not able to bring a bed, I will give a try now, and I hope that I could contribute more on your show.
Sammy, World Outrage is screaming on your behalf, and my voice is one of them. Our hearts are with you, and let's stay in touch, and we'll talk again. I'll let you go out and try to find some bread for your family.
And I hope your listeners just support the freedom, support those who are fighting for freedom, not other people.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sammy. I'll let you go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Jack, you still with me?
I'm still here.
Oh, it's a pretty awful situation over there. It's got me very, very focused and obsessed. But the other major topic that has me feeling the same way is the economic crisis that is global. It's serious. And you've done such wonderful writing about it. I must tell you, that when I get my Z magazine, if you have an article in it, I go to that first along with one other. Edward Herman has a monthly Fog Watch column, and that's in there all the time. And I go to that and I read it. And when I see you, I read yours, because you've done some, you do some fabulous writing on the economy, and anybody can read your material and they can really get an awful lot of insight into what's going on. But let me let you pick up the story and talk about what you see happening. The recession that you wrote about.
Right. We were talking about the characteristic of the current epic recession. Epic recession is, as we said earlier, something far more severe than a normal recession. It has characteristics of a classic depression. It's not yet a depression. It's kind of like a hybrid state, unstable, and is moving in the direction of a classic bona fide depression a la 1929-34 or, you know, 1890s, 1870s, 1830s. We've had similar epic events leading to depressions. So it has many of the same characteristics, and in the article and book, I'm clarifying what those characteristics are. There's at least 10 major characteristics. So it, epic recession shares characteristics of both a normal recession and depression. But the momentum, of course, is currently building and moving towards the direction of a depression. We aren't in the depression yet, I don't believe that, but we certainly are experiencing double-digit unemployment and some of the other characteristics of now we're beginning to see deflation and deflationary psychology, which is driving us in that direction. Defaults not only on the financial side but on the non-financial corporate side, all of which lead to more deeper recession conditions. I had predicted back in some of my articles in early 2008, that's February, March, that we were going to have mass layoffs and we're going to have bank failures occur before the end of the year. That was even before the Bear Stearns event in March, and pretty much has come to be the case. And right now my prediction is that we've seen about 5 to 6 million when properly calculated on net new unemployment over the past 13 months since the recession began. We could see another 5 to 7 million over the next year. That would put us at about 20 million unemployed when properly calculated to account for the massive increase of conversion of full-time to part-time employees going on at the same time we have regular layoffs and a large increase of long-term discouraged unemployed when properly calculated. We've got already 13 million. We could easily go to 20 million. It all depends largely upon what happens with this program, Obama program.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
To the News Hour. I'm on with Jack Ramses. Jack, next Monday, I'll have economist John Williams on the program, and he reverse engineers government data to try to fix what they don't want to tell us. I get alerts what he'll send out. He's got a subscription service, but anybody can sign up for his alerts. And I got an alert last Friday, I think it was. Included was his estimate of the real unemployment figure, and he shows a graph. He doesn't give the exact number, but you can read it pretty close, and it looks like he's saying that the true unemployment figure is somewhere on the order of 17.5%. That's a pretty staggering number if he's got that right.
Well, it's a number that is not created, out of the ether. It's a number that can be estimated from all the government data. As I was saying, unemployment today, official unemployment, is much less than actual unemployment because it doesn't count for the underemployment, particularly the massive growth of part-time employees, nor the long-time discouraged employees. Plus, you need to remember that this government data that's being reported is a statistic, meaning it's not a true number. It's an estimated number. And the government performs a lot of statistical manipulations on the raw data, the actual number of unemployed, and those manipulations significantly underestimate. For example, just to give you one way they manipulate it, is they estimate historically what they believe are long-term trends for small business employment growth. So they'll take a long-term average, and they'll take that small business where most of the employment growth is, and they'll reduce the actual unemployment levels by that assumption, when actually small business may be laying off hundreds of thousands at the very same time. So that's just one major way. And, of course, they don't cover the underemployed, and they don't cover discouraged, missing labor force, and so forth. These techniques have been developed largely since Reagan to modulate the unemployment rate, make it lower than it is, and keep it from wild swings. They do that with the inflation rate and GDP rate as well. But, you know, the only point I want to make is an element of epic recession is when you get unemployment levels over 10% of the labor force. We're clearly over 10% now. And if we continue the way economic indicators are, we'll have more than 20 million unemployed, 20 to 25 million by the end of the year. And, that clearly puts us in a category that is not a normal recession. Other characteristics of epic recession are it's characterized by deflation and debt-driven defaults. For example, just since the year 2000, if you use the Federal Reserve flow of funds data, we've taken on $22 trillion of net new debt. In 1980, all forms of debt, and I mean government debt, corporate debt, banking debt, and consumer debt, was less than $5 trillion. Today, it's about $49 trillion, $22 trillion of that just since 2000. And most of that debt, virtually all of that debt, is corporate debt. You know, it's a misunderstanding to think, oh, the consumer has been spending beyond his means and so forth. We've only had a net credit installment debt increase of 1%, and government debt of, $1 trillion, and government debt of $3 trillion. But the rest of that $17-18 trillion is all corporate debt. And that corporate debt is what's unwinding now and what is causing this financial crisis and banking crisis. Most of the banks are, I believe, virtually in default, virtually broke. They're not telling us about it.
Well, I think they
have been throwing money at it just to keep the banks afloat. And as the banks, you know, enter this kind of a crisis for over a year now, they stop lending, and that causes contraction in the real economy, which we're beginning to see after a year. And defaults now occurring most obviously in auto and elsewhere. In the real non-financial economy, which eventually will feed back, I believe, if they don't check and contain this thing with a program in the next 6 months, we're going to see another round of financial crisis and banking failures at the end of the year. And this is exactly what happened in the 1930s. We had four rounds of banking crises each year during the period 1929 to 1934, which fed into the non-financial economy, causing more layoffs, more defaults, which fed back on the financial system. So this is like 1930-31 in many ways. Folks at that time didn't think they were in a depression either. They thought it was a serious recession that would correct itself. Of course, we know it didn't correct itself, but there was a transition period between you know, the actual beginning of the downturn and the actual depression, which was very similar to what we're experiencing right now.
We really have a colossal debt problem. I wonder if you agree, and I suspect that, you might. All of this money creation, if we have a debt problem, how on earth do you solve a debt problem by piling on trillions more in debt? The analogy that strikes me, Jack, is like treating an alcoholic by giving him more alcohol. They may buy some short-term relief. The alcoholic will feel pretty good after a few more drinks, but the more he takes, the bigger the hangover in the end.
Well, one way of looking at the crisis is that they haven't solved the debt problem. They've just moved it from the bank balance sheets to the government balance sheets.
Yeah.
And so it's not really unwound yet, and it's in the process of doing that. And as long as the debt is unwinding, prices will continue to fall. A good example is the housing industry.
We had another break coming up.
We have deflation going on.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. I'm on with Jack Ramses. We're talking about the economic crisis. Jack, you talk about, and pretty obvious, that they certainly are making a great effort. The combo of the Fed and the Treasury making a great effort to bail out the bankers, bail out the insurers, bail out the mortgage lenders. It looks like the auto companies will get a smidgen too. if you could say all those billions are a smidgen. I mean, the bankers need trillions. What bothers me is the last number I heard was on the order of $8.5 trillion has either been handed out, or most of it has been pledged. So it's there for the taking if the bankers need it, and big banks like Citigroup got an initial group. 12 big banks were picked out for top money, and then smaller ones are getting some smaller amounts as well. But the big ones like Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, they got $25 billion. My understanding is Citi got at least another $20 billion. AIG has gotten multiple handouts. The Fed is handing out a couple of trillion or more, and they refuse to say who the money is going to. A lovely way to run a country. And, of course, these people literally committed massive fraud. They came up with these securitized assets that was nothing but toxic junk, or pretty close to it. And they peddled it to the whole world, including an awful lot of smart people, Jack, who bought this stuff. But of course it hurts everybody and everything when the economy, gets in big trouble. One of the things that bothers me is the amount of debt that these, banks have and the amount of it that's toxic is so enormous that how on earth are they gonna get rid of it all? How on earth are they gonna do that? Are they just simply gonna forget about it?
Well, the actual numbers, the Federal Reserve has committed or loaned out about $2.5 trillion, and they have commitments maybe for another trillion or so. And of course, the Treasury has loans and grants and commitments for about $1 trillion. So it's about $4 trillion that's actually been committed or loaned. I believe it'll take about $8 trillion to really stabilize the bank. So they're not even halfway there. As I said earlier, they're really technically broke. The government's not telling us that. They're trying to keep them afloat. And as you pointed out, some of them are getting hundreds of billions of dollars. Citigroup is an example. They've got about $45 billion actual and credit insurance of about $300 billion from the government. Citigroup is one of the largest banks in the world. And it's technically insolvent. It's got $1.2 trillion in liabilities that they're keeping off the books and about $800 billion in deposits and assets. So Citigroup is technically broke. That's why they're trying to break it up and merge it in pieces and parts, you know, with Morgan Stanley and others. But all the banks are in the same condition. That's why when the talk first came out, $700 billion, you know, the first immediate commitment was $125 billion to these big banks that weren't supposed to be in trouble, the remaining big nine or big six, if you would. But we've got about $3.5 to $4 trillion committed, but, you know, none of that is committed to solve the fundamental problem of the collapse of values and assets in the banking system, particularly in the mortgage system. It's all been designed to sort of offset the hole in the balance sheets that's been opening up, not to really resolve the fundamental problem, which lies in the housing markets and not with the short-term credit markets. And that's been the big error of Bernanke and Paulson, not really solving the fundamental problem, but dealing with, you know, trying to stave off the collapse of the banks by giving them what's called more and more liquidity, but that doesn't solve the fundamental problem. It also shows, by the way, though, the massive power, political power of the finance capital in the U.S. To be able to extract from the government, the taxpayer, you know, $3 to $4 trillion without solving the fundamental problem.
Well, Jack, it's real easy when you have a Federal Reserve that's a private for-profit banking cartel. So the banks own the Federal Reserve. So the banks can get the Fed to pump as many trillions to the banks as the banks want, without making it look absolutely obscene. Well, I think a few trillion or whatever. I mean, heaven only knows how much they've actually gotten. My suspicion, Jack, is that they continue to get more, and the true amounts that they've gotten have been hidden from us, and we may never find out.
Well, there's probably some truth to that, particularly since the Fed doesn't want to tell us what's going on, how much they've committed to whom, and the Treasury, the other player in this, and won't say how the TARP funds have been distributed. You got to be suspicious when you have these two government agencies refusing to tell the general public and even Congress what they spent, where they spent it. Some truth probably to what you say. So my numbers are really the low end, $2.5 trillion, $1 trillion.
Oh, yeah.
That's the official number. Yeah.
Other
characteristics of epic recession are currency instability, synchronized global recession, financial institution instability, and the failure of monetary policy, and I believe we may see the failure of fiscal policy this year as well.
Let's talk about fiscal policy, because you see that as the possible way to see the light at the end of a very long tunnel. And I guess if it's used right, it certainly can have an effect. My great fear is that it will not be used right. My feeling is that housing is very central to the big dilemma we're facing. I don't know what the total number of homes that have been foreclosed on so far, but we're getting into the millions of homeowners that have or will lose their homes. We have to do something to stop this. And I think people like Professor Schiller up at Yale sees this continuing for some time. This is not over yet. This still has a pretty long way to run, maybe through all of 2009. Who knows? But this is the worst housing crisis ever in our history. I think it will surpass what happened in the 1930s. And housing is the major asset for most people, not stocks and bonds. It's their home. So if they're worried about losing their homes and their jobs, then they stop spending, and the economy just sinks lower and lower and lower. I suspect that if we don't help individual households, consumers, then whatever fiscal stimulus is going to happen is not going to solve the problem. Am I off base thinking that?
No, the housing sector economy, I would say, is in depression. That sector in particular already, far worse than even the epic recession. There are somewhere between 2 and 3 million foreclosures, and it's projected by the rating agencies, Moody's and others, that we may have as many as 5 to 7 million foreclosures occurring over this particular downturn and cycle. And that's a big, big problem. That's what's driving the deflation. Housing asset values driving the deflation, which is keeps opening the hole in the financial and banking institutions' balance sheet. Bernanke and Paulson keep throwing money into that hole, but it keeps getting wider because they're committed to dealing with a short-term problem at the banks, the balance sheet, rather than addressing, as you point out, the fundamental problem, which is the collapse of home prices. And the housing market collapse, which I predict will fall at least another 20% in terms of prices.
Well, that's pretty staggering.
Seeing the end of that. Yeah, we're about halfway there in the housing crisis.
So we're
that's why my program addresses the housing crisis as well as jobs as the two main areas that have to be addressed. And it has to do with restoring income and consumption to 90 million people. Who make $80,000 a year and below annual income. That's the key to the problem. We've got a consumption collapse going on here, particularly since September. Not surprising, given the income shift that's been going on for the last three decades.
And you've certainly written a lot about that, a trillion or more annually shifted upward to the top.
Yes, that's the result of policies, various policies that have been instituted since Reagan and continued right through all the administrations, have, according to my calculations, resulted in a shift of income of about $1 trillion every year from the bottom 80% households to the wealthiest 5% and even 1%. If you look at the wealthiest 1% households in the U.S. in 1979, they had about 8% of the total national income. In 2006, they had increased that to 22% of total income, which is very similar to what happened in the 1920s. By 1929, it was 22% held by the wealthiest 1%. The rest of, particularly the bottom 80%, has had stagnant incomes, actually falling weekly wages adjusted for inflation over the course of 30 years. So what has that 90 million households done for 30 years? Well, basically they've turned towards working extra jobs, putting spouses to work, working second jobs. Americans work the longest hours of anybody in the industrial world. They've taken on the credit, installment credit, and they've refinanced their homes and, depleted their savings. And that's how they've kept up with the lack of income growth for the last 30 years. Now, of course, all of those temporary fixes are now coming to an end very abruptly all at once. So it's not surprising that consumption's fallen off a cliff. At the same time, of course, what little assets they have in their 401ks, they're depleting, and their housing prices are collapsing. And if they have any money in small stocks, that's all collapsing. So across the board, the consumer is getting hammered. We had $5 a gallon prices over the summer, so it's come sort of like a you know, everything's converged at once, and it's knocked the consumer right off its feet. And that's why we've had such an extreme collapse in the last 3 months in the real economy. And unless we do something long-term about redistributing income, and unless we do something short-term, meaning 2 years, about massively injecting income into you know, most of the spending population, this crisis will not be contained, but will continue to turn down. And that's what I believe is the fault of the Obama program. It's really too little too late if we're talking about $775 billion, 40% are tax cuts, most of that for businesses and wealthy. We're talking really about a spending bill of only $400 billion, and he's talking about 4 million jobs generated from that. No way. No way. It's going to take at least a $1 trillion jobs program alone, plus another $1 trillion to stabilize the housing industry, just to check and contain this downturn. So I'm not convinced that we're going to get the necessary fiscal policy. And of course, what we see is Republicans and corporations and the right wing actively lobbying and trying to even prevent the, you know, the $700 billion being spent properly. So I suspect it will be on the fiscal side in 2009 too little too late, just as in 2008 it was monetary policy too little too late. And we could very well see by the end of this year a further deterioration, or early 2010, of the economic crisis.
So
it's a possibility. It's a scenario that's not impossible.
We both know that nobody can predict the future, but we could take a look at what's already been done. We can see from what has been said about proposals going forward. And I agree with you, Jack. I think we have an awful lot to worry about. There's no question that both the Democrat and Republican parties will help business first and consumers whatever they may get afterward. And Wall Street elected Obama. They, as an industry, if we can call them that, they put up more campaign funding than any other single group. And they want their pound of flesh back with heavy doses of interest. And they're going to get it. So the banks are getting it. Industry wants it. Putting it into bricks and mortar work. I don't know how that really does very much. It didn't do very much in the 1930s. People need to know they've got a job. They need to be earning an income. They need to know that their homes are safe. They won't lose them. And I just can't imagine that people don't realize if we don't solve those problems, then business is going to be rotten no matter how many billions you give away to it. But I worry, like you do, that that's not the thinking in Washington.
Well, it's thinking very similar, as I said earlier, about to 1930-31, that they felt that the situation would correct itself. They just had to figure a way to hold out during the storm, and you know, that the economy would come around. And that's kind of the attitude of the banks and finance capital. You know, plug our balance sheet here, and you know, things will get better eventually. And that's the big fundamental error. They won't get better eventually, because unless you do something about the consumption collapse and income collapse on the you know, 91 million working and middle class families, the thing won't get better. That's why I'm critical of Obama's composition, not just the magnitude of his bailout program. The composition focuses heavily on infrastructure and industries that haven't even taken off, like alternative fuels and so forth. You're just not going to generate the jobs, and it's going to take a lot longer, and it's going to cost a lot more per job. Estimates are like $83,000 per job in infrastructure development. When you've got millions of people being laid off who have no construction or public works work experience, and you know, how are you going to employ them quickly? That's why my $1 trillion job program allocates money to infrastructure job development, but also $300 billion to hiring public employees, state, local, and school district employees, another $100 billion for areas where we already have had job growth, like healthcare and so forth, $100 billion for manufacturing jobs, additional for auto the auto industry bailout, and then finally at least $125 billion is going to be needed over the next 2 years for unemployment, increases in unemployment benefits, food stamps, Medicare, job training, and so forth. So it has to be a better composition of spending in order to generate jobs more quickly, particularly in other sectors of the economy other than construction. And, of course, that's not as profitable for industry, and that's why non-financial companies don't want to spend the money in those directions as well.
That's
what's going to happen. And then it will take at least another $1 trillion to bail out the housing industry. And at the heart of that, I have three proposals. One is to reset interest rates for all mortgages taken out between 2002 and 2007 to the equivalent of the federal funds rate plus 2%, which would make it about a 2% rate right now, and also to reset principals to a six-year moving average. Those two measures would put a lot of income in the hands of homeowners that wouldn't take tax cuts that would exacerbate the trillion-dollar deficits we're already
beginning to see. Indeed they would, Jack. We need to take another break, and then we'll come back and finish up the program. Welcome back. I'm on with Jack Rasmus. Jack, let me mention your books again that listeners can get, or they certainly will be able to very shortly. One titled The Trillion Dollar Income Shift, Essays on Income Inequality in America. In other words, how they take from the common folks and give to the rich folks a trillion plus every year for many years running. And your other one that you emailed me about, Epic Recession and Global Financial Crisis. If those two aren't vital reading topics, I don't know what is. I don't know what are. They certainly are vital. And let me ask you to do one other thing too, Jack. Give listeners your website so they can go there, they can learn more about you, they can learn about all of your work, your books, your writing, and so on.
Yes, all my published articles are on the website, as well as my public presentations and radio and TV interviews. And that website is www.kyklosproductions.com, spelled K-Y-K-L-O-S, productions, plural, .com, all one word,
kyklosproductions.com. If they just Google your name, will they also come right to it?
Yes, if they go Jack Rasmus, R-A-S-M-U-S is the last name, they should be able to find that reference.
I think that's probably the easiest way to do it. When I want to get to my own blog, I simply type in Steve Lindman blog, and it pops up right on the top.
Mm-hmm.
So people can find your work and your books and writings and lectures and so on. Jack Rasmus, R-A-S-M-U-S. Just Google it, Jack Rasmus, and your site will pop up. Jack, we got a couple of minutes left. Wrap it up, and there's no question you're talking about some very sensible policies. We can only dream that some of them will be implemented beginning in a week or so. A week from Wednesday, is it? Today's the 12th. 8 more days, a week from tomorrow. We can only hope. But Jack, wrap it up very quickly. Final comments that you can make.
Okay, two brief comments. One, to really stop the core of the problem in the housing industry, we're going to have to create what I call a Homeowners Small Business Loan Corporation, or HSBLC, which would essentially run a nationalized mortgage market. In other words, we're going to have to nationalize the residential mortgage market and small business property market, and that's where that $1 trillion comes in for financing that whole process. And I won't go over that in more detail. I'll be describing it in future articles and in my book and so forth. That's the key, I believe. Very similar to what happened in the 1930s. Housing prices fell for 6 years until Homeowners Loan Corporation was created in 1935, and only then did the housing prices stop falling. The other point I would like to make is how do we finance the $2 trillion, and what do we do long term? Well,
very quickly, Jack, because we're almost out of time. Very quickly.
Okay, we need to roll back capital income taxation back to 1980, and we need to repatriate at least half. That's $2 trillion. Of the $4 trillion stuffed away by wealthy investors and corporations in offshore tax shelters, these are 27 islands across the world where they've been stuffing their profits. In 1985, there was $250 billion in offshore shelters. Today, there's somewhere between $6 and $11 trillion in these shelters, and we need to repatriate. In other words, make them bring that money back and put it in the U.S. banking system that would refloat the banks and require them to properly pay taxes.
Jack, we're out of time. We're out of time.
Okay. At least two of the four financial solutions.
Oh, my goodness. An obscenity that all those trillions the fat cats pay nothing on. Jack, you've got to come back and so we can pick this up again. This story is not going away in a hurry. We'll be talking about it a year from today. It's been a great hour, Jack. I'm very, very grateful to you for coming on. I'll look for all of your articles as they come out. It's vital reading. It affects everybody. Everybody. We need to know about this. We need to stay in touch. Again, my great thanks to you, Jack.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And bye-bye. Come back tomorrow. We will pick it up with another guest and more important topics to talk.